Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What toll does war take on the bodies and minds of military service members? And is it possible to return to their old lives when they don't feel like their old selves? Brian Kastner was deployed to the Middle East 3 times during his 8 years with the Air Force, twice as head of an explosive ordnance disposal unit in the Iraq War. He came home with no visible wounds, and yet he found his brain and indeed his soul irrevocably changed by his experiences, so that a whole new fight awaited him stateside as he tried to reintegrate into life with his family. Brian Kastner currently works as a civilian contractor training EOD teams for the U.S. military. His new memoir is called The Long Walk, a story of war and the life that follows. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that the very first thing we need to know about you is that you are crazy with a capital C, and admitting that to the world for you is, you say, like a sort of coming out.
I guess a little bit. I didn't tell everyone I knew. It's not like it was the topic of conversation all the time. I only told people that I really thought they were going to get it, so to speak. I put it in the book because my goal for the book was always to make it feel as real and honest as I could, and that was certainly part of it.
And what is the crazy, as you call it? Because at times it reads like rage, other times it's despair, sometimes confusion and fear and loneliness. Does it change shape for you from one day to the next?
It did. I think it's all those things. I think it's more than those. I used a capital C because it felt like something outside of me a little bit, even though it was all internal.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like something that was happening to me, and I had a feeling that I did not have a name for.
Yeah.
And if I couldn't call it pain or something else, and I needed a new word, and crazy seemed to fit.
In a way, it seems almost like you have crazy as opposed to being crazy, if that makes sense to you, that distinction.
I understand what you mean a little bit. It's something that happened to me one day, and it walked behind me and ruined every single thing I was doing all day long. And fortunately, it doesn't come back quite as often as it used to. There was a time, really, when it was just so uncontrollable and intolerable, and that's really what made it awful, is that I didn't know what caused it, which may be surprising because, you know, in your intro, and as you kind of describe what I was in the military, and I did this job and everything else, but it really only struck me a couple years after I got back. And so I didn't know where it came from. I didn't know how to control it. I didn't know how to stop it. And it just never, ever stopped. And that was really the worst part.
So before we continue, we should talk about what your job required when you were deployed to Iraq. Explosive ordnance disposal is basically a fancy way of saying bomb removal.
That's right. We're the military's bomb squad. And so in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the fight has really revolved around IEDs, those are improvised explosive devices, because that was such a central weapon in the war, still is, this job that used to be a little bit on the periphery or used to be just a little specialized, we were only really needed in certain key situations, it turned into a job we did every day, many times a day.
Hmm.
And that could involve either taking apart an IED once it was found, if it was found first. More often, it had detonated, and so we were doing an investigation, like a detective, of what was it, what made it go off, what was the target, those kind of things. And if we were really, really lucky, we would either find weapons caches and be able to get rid of them before they were used, or find a bomb maker on a raid and be able to take apart his workshop. And unfortunately, that last part really doesn't happen very often, or at least to me in my experience.
You write that you signed up for EOD training because you expected it to be challenging. Can you talk about what appealed to you about the nature of that work?
Sure. It's really just that it was really, really hard. And I knew that if I succeeded at that, I could really say I had done something. It wasn't the adrenaline. Some guys just, they like the idea of working with explosives. It's exciting. I guess there was a little bit of that, if I admit it to myself, but you know, I did fairly well in school. I got good grades, and that wasn't as big of a challenge. But the thing about EOD was, you had to have the book smarts, you had to know what to do, and then you actually had to go and physically do something about it. You mm-hmm. couldn't just know the right answer. You needed to be able to apply it and work with your hands as well. And being able to do both of those things, I just thought was great. And then, you know, the school itself is so hard and is such a crucible. 30 of us started in my class, and only 3 of us finished together. And so I knew when I was done, that school was harder than college. It was harder than my master's degree. It was harder than anything I've done since.
And as supervisors are looking at you along the way, they're also evaluating your ability to work within a team, because this ends up being truly a life or death matter when you're on the field.
Right. It's not just being smart's important, but that's not enough, and being a tinkerer or mechanically inclined is important, but that's not enough. You're never going to do anything alone in the EOD world. You're always going to be on a team, be working for somebody else, be part of a 3-person unit, be in charge of other teams, which is what I did as an officer almost immediately. So you have to fit into the group, to the brotherhood, and the brotherhood, once you're part of it, you know, you've got this new family that you do everything with.
How much awareness is there on the part of service members before they deploy that active duty in a war might fundamentally change you?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. And I hesitate to speak for too many people or to speak for more people than me.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say in general that's just not the frame you use to think about it. That it's not that they think it will change them or not change them. It's just simply not a relevant concern. The concern is getting through EOD school, and then the concern is going and actually doing the job and really wanting to put all these skills to use. And then the concern is survival, making it through your tour and getting all of your bros home together. And then once you're back, well, then you're probably getting ready to go again and
yeah.
do it. You know, you've got a couple months at home, you see your family, you try to go on vacation, maybe your child is born or something, and then you go back into the training pipeline and you do it all over again. And there's just never the time to sit back and think, I wonder what's happening to me through all of this.
Well, you know, when you describe it that way, Brian, it makes perfect sense that it took a while for your symptoms, or the worst of them anyway, to hit you, because that was when you finally had time to relax.
Right. And in fact, I tried hard not to relax. I tried hard to stay as busy as I was in the military. And when I got out, I really got out because the military lifestyle is so hard on families, that my marriage was not in a good place and I wasn't the kind of father I wanted to be. And I really had to pick my family or active duty military. And I picked my family. But then the next thing I did was choose to be a consultant and go on the road 30 weeks a year training other guys before they go. And I basically swapped out my uniform for, you know, contractor's gear. And I was doing exactly the same thing, except I was on the training side instead of the doing side.
For someone ultimately diagnosed with PTSD and with traumatic brain injury, and we'll get into that in a moment, it would seem like going into this kind of consulting is the worst possible thing you can do for yourself. You're relying on, people are relying on you to relive these experiences every single day.
Right, but I guess I can understand that, you putting it that way. I feel like it was really, maybe not quite therapeutic, but actually really good for me in that it helped slowly ease me into the civilian world, because the guys I was teaching with were all former military. They were all retired or guys who had gotten out like me. And so they, you know, we were our own little family traveling around, and we had a lot of the same feelings and concerns. And this is maybe a good point to say that, you know, I wrote a book about what happened to me, but what happened to me I consider fairly average. I did not have that extraordinary of a tour, multiple tours in Iraq. I didn't go more than other guys. I didn't see or do anything worse than other guys. And I think my reaction when I got home is pretty typical, too.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most striking aspects of all this, is that if you are struggling in this way and have been able to articulate it, there have to be a lot of other people out there in the same boat.
Right. Right. And I am very, very lucky, and I consider myself very fortunate because I am on an extreme mild end of traumatic brain injury and some of the other mental health issues that I have. In that I, you know, I have some friends that are maybe not quite on the couch all day, but they have trouble getting up, they have trouble doing things, they have trouble with making decisions. They sleep an hour to a night and nothing else. They really have no short-term memory from one day to the next. They're really, really struggling. And I have some of that enough that I feel it, but I'm fortunate that it's no worse.
So let's talk about traumatic brain injury, because I think sometimes when people have a picture of this, they imagine someone who, you know, has half their skull crushed by an explosion. Your case, it sounds like, was more like what NFL football players experience, concussion after concussion after concussion, and it builds up over time.
Well, a little bit in the occupational exposure, but I think you highlight an interesting or an important, I should say, distinction that's not always made in our popular understanding, because concussions with football players or hockey players or boxers or whatever are really gaining a lot of national attention. But the mechanism of injury is really very different. The concussion is when your brain smushes into the inside of your skull because your head hit something or stopped very quickly or something like that. And this happens to people in car accidents and when they fall off a wall or something like that. And that can happen to soldiers, to folks in the military, if they do get in a vehicle accident or when they get blown up, if they get thrown a long distance and hit their head. But there's another mechanism of injury, which is the blast-induced traumatic brain injury, which is what I have that really mild case of. And in blast-induced, what that means is the blast waves themselves from the detonation is what caused the damage. And a blast wave, to get into the physics just very briefly, moves like a sound wave, and it speeds up or slows down depending on how dense the material is that it's moving through. Well, when that blast wave hits your body, you know, it speeds up through your skin and your skull and through your guts and every little piece of you, and everywhere that there's a change in density, it moves at a different speed. Well, this is what causes damage to your lungs and can make you bleed internally. When it goes through your brain, though, it rips all those little synapses and bumps and nodules and everything else that you have in your brain, and you can regrow some of those paths, and it can take a long time, but, you know, you can lose everything from long-term memories to, like I alluded to before, some of your short-term memory. You know, some people have to relearn to walk if it's a really single traumatic incident. And fortunately, I didn't have any one incident that was so bad, but the occupational exposure of blowing something up every single day means that your brain rips just a little bit every single day, and you cause a lot of insidious damage that's not necessarily apparent immediately.
My guest is Brian Kastner. He's a U.S. Air Force veteran of the Iraq War, a Bronze Star recipient, and currently works as a civilian contractor training explosive ordnance disposal teams for the U.S. military. His new book is called The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Iraq War veteran Brian Kastner is with us. His new memoir is called The Long Walk, a story of war and the life that follows. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Brian, can you describe what it feels like physically to experience a blast wave like one of the many that caused the brain damage that you experienced?
It's like being at fireworks on the 4th of July, except multiply it by 1,000, mm-hmm. I guess. So you feel the thud in your chest. I had my very first day in Iraq on my first tour, I was woken up by a mortar exploding on the runway, which was only a couple hundred yards away, and I felt the thud. The thud and the moving through your body is what woke me up, not the sound. And, of course, that happened all the time. So it's this, but it's more than just a thud in your chest. It's like you feel it in your gut. But maybe the scary part is you never feel it in your head necessarily. You can have trouble hearing afterwards. You can feel disoriented. You can, you can be confused a little bit, but not, it's not like you actually feel it in there.
Hmm. You write that when you go to war, you must mentally prepare yourself to be shot. First of all, what does that mean, and then how do you do it?
So I learned both in EOD school and in a lot of the shooting training that we did, a lot of it is just visualization, which going back to sports again is what a lot of athletes do. You know, the day before the big game, they imagine catching the touchdown or whatever the case may be. And you do a lot of that. You mentally prepare. You work your way through what would happen, what will it feel like, what actions will I take if all of these different terrible things happen. And you think that when you drive down the road, what if that car blows up right now? What if that person starts shooting at me? And you imagine, you visualize them doing it, and then you visualize your response to it. You shoot back. You drive away from the car. You stop and get out to investigate it. And what helps, or how that helps, is then when the thing actually happens, when you really do get blown up, you have all of this muscle memory and training that takes over, and you just do whatever you had visualized doing. Now, I'm fortunate. I've never been shot. But part of the shooting training that we did was not just shooting your rifle or going from your rifle to your pistol or all the various other things you do, but visualizing being shot in the chest, and your plate is going to absorb that, and it, you know, what's that going to feel like? And then after that happens, what does it feel like to shoot back, you know, and kind of just mentally work through that. So when you do get shot, you don't just stand there and look at your chest and, you know, are amazed that you're still living.
So that ability to keep your wits about you would certainly keep you alive in a war theater, but it's hard to turn off when you're driving down the streets of Buffalo with your kids in the backseat.
That's exactly right. You do the same, you go through the same process, and my brain was on overdrive, and not necessarily about anything specific. I had put away, I did not imagine people on, like a specific person on the street shooting at me with my kids in the van, mm-hmm. but it was just it was underneath all the time. And so it wasn't that I needed to protect my children from something specific. It's that I just had this overwhelming need to keep them safe. And the way I knew to keep my kids safe is the way I knew to keep, you know, I kept all my EOD brothers safe, which is how you drive and having your rifle around and, you know, all of these basic safety things you do. You don't put your back to the door, and you don't let your kids put their back to the door.
You write about the night your 3-day-old son came home from the hospital. You perched at the top of the stairs in your house with a rifle.
I did. I did that many times, not just the night that he came home. I had seen so many dead children in Iraq that, you know, babies are just so helpless that there was, you know, there would be nothing that he could do about it. So, you know, again, it's my job to keep him safe since he can't, you know, defend himself. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of just basic new fatherhood in that, but I can't parse out from my own experience what part of it is just naturally being a new father and what part of it is the experiences of war. They're all intertwined and fused in my head. And so I kept my guys safe in Iraq, and I'm going to keep my children safe, and it's just the natural transition, I guess, is how it feels to me.
Did your wife ever come out of the bedroom and see you, and what was her reaction?
She did, and she would, I had been acting a little odd anyway, and so, you know, she would get me to come back to bed, or she would, try to calm me down a little bit, but we weren't necessarily talking so much, and she falls asleep quickly, so she didn't necessarily see me doing this all the time.
You write about her asking her grandmother, whose husband had fought in World War II, for advice on how she could help you when you came home. And her grandmother said something to her that was really chilling.
Right. Her grandmother said that I would not come home, and said that, you know, the better, I wasn't coming home either way. You know, the me that I had been before wasn't coming back, and better that I die over there than I come home and die with her. And this was her direct experience. Her grandmother lost her husband, a couple decades after the war. He had a heart attack at a very early age, and her grandmother had seen a lot of loss. You know, this is the Depression era generation, and had really been one tragedy after another in her family, and her perspective was that you just don't come home the same way. You're lost one way or the other.
Under what circumstances did Jessie, and that's your wife's name, did she actually tell you that story? Because I would think that she kept it to herself for a while before she shared it with you.
Right. She told me. Now this is where my memory starts to unravel a bit, because I do have some long-term memory issues, and a lot of them are in related to various things in our marriage. But if I remember right, I didn't hear about that until we were in marriage counseling. Mm. And I write very briefly about that in the book. And one of the things about writing a book like this is that lots of stuff happens to you, but not all of it necessarily makes it to the book. And so we had a lot of marriage counseling that was really very effective, but didn't seem to have the right place in the book. But some of the revelations that came out during it did make it in the book, and that was one of those. Is I didn't always feel like I was a different person. I don't, you know, she had to tell me, for example, that I didn't laugh for a year when I came home. Hmm. I don't necessarily remember it that way, but the first year I got back is kind of a blur anyway.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Bethany in Dallas. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, thank you for having this on the air.
Sure.
My son is a veteran who also worked with explosives in the military. He came home. He definitely has the brain injury from it. He, too, as you said, didn't laugh for a while, and now pretty much everything either makes him mad or it's totally stupidly funny. And beyond that, how does one actually help somebody with that type of a brain injury get beyond the little idiosyncrasies that society would say, yeah, you're really warped, you need help, you need to be in a psych unit? And as a result of his injuries also, he gets these horrendous migraines that just come out of the blue, and the next thing you know, he's almost in the emergency room. I've personally taken him 3 times now. Yeah. So what's your take on that? And I can take your answer off the air.
Oh, well, thank you for your question. A lot of that feels right to me, or I can identify with. I never got really angry, but a lot of my friends did. And so I know that that's a common thing. And I had the same horrendously funny problem. I used to tell horribly inappropriate jokes about, you know, dismembered bodies and, you know, just really awful things. And I had no filter, is the way I describe it. And my wife really helped me redevelop a filter. And if I'm not careful, I go back to that. I wish I had a single piece of advice. I didn't necessarily write a happy book or a how-to book or a, you know, starting on chapter 10, this is how you all fix it book, because I don't know. But I can say that my wife was incredibly loyal and incredibly patient. And I think you hit on an important thing, which is that the person doesn't feel, I mean, I said I was crazy, but that's as much of a me reinforcing the own stereotype to myself or me fearing for that for myself as much as an actual, I mean, it's not a diagnosis, of course. And so you can have a lot of issues that don't have a nice entry in the doctor's manuals that you fit some very specific condition. You don't fit something, but obviously something's not right. And so the loyalty and the patience, and I wish I had more than that, except that at the VA I eventually was able to work through a lot of, you know, figure out which part was the anxiety and which part was the TBI and which part was each of these other little bits, and it took a while, but we eventually figured out what came from what.
Early in the book, you share a very clear memory of getting your first tattoo with a good friend the day before your second son was born. And although you can remember how angry your wife was with you about the tattoo, later in the book you tell us you don't remember the births of your boys.
Right, and this is just the most infuriating thing. You know, when you asked me, like, when did she tell me about her grandmother, and I hope I gave you the right answer. Like, I'm not really sure, and it's the why can I remember one thing but I can't remember another thing, and then you tell yourself, you know what, you're just getting older. This happens to lots of people. Lots of people can't remember stuff. Lots of people, you know, they have this trouble. But you're 30 years old, mm-hmm. You know, and you shouldn't be forgetting all of these things, especially something as important as your kids being born. So sometimes there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason about what sticks and what doesn't, except that I knew I had nearly every memory in Iraq crystal clear, and I knew that I had whole bunches of stuff with my wife and kids that just wasn't there anymore.
Yeah, what's so interesting about that, Brian, and, you know, we talk so much about the sacrifices of members of the military and of their families. We understand that you trade away time with your family in order to serve your country. I think few of us have recognized that maybe you'll be trading away even memories of things that already happened. I mean, that seems like a double sacrifice.
Right, and, you know, for a long time, my wife thought I was doing it purposely. Hmm. I picked the war over her, which in some cases I literally did. You know, I literally, you know, I didn't have to go back for another tour. I could have been done with my obligation, and I chose to go back, you know. So, but the consequences of that, I didn't just pick to go back another time. I picked the consequences, which means, you know, I'm choosing this memory of the war over this memory of her. Again, this doesn't, you know, this is what happened to me. This doesn't happen to everybody. This is not every veteran's story. It's my story. But as, you know, when I do book signings or when I talk to people, they say a lot of times, thank you for saying so. The same things are happening to me. Hmm. Or I noticed the same thing. Or, you know, a lot of it rang true for my fellow, you know, EOD brothers especially, and that's really important to me.
Regarding that second tour to Iraq, you write, I needed to be back. I would do better this time. What did you mean by better?
Well, I got fired on my first tour. I went to Balad in 2005, and we had, you know, I was in the Air Force, but we were supporting the Army. And when the Army called for an IED, we would respond, but the Air Force chain of command still had their, you know, there's still a lot of boxes that needed to be checked for them to say it was okay to do this. And so there's a lot of the bureaucracies figuring out how to work together. And I needed some robots fixed, and the Air Force hadn't given me permission to go and get them fixed, but I went anyway, and I got caught, and so I was relieved of my command, and it was really important to me that I make up for that, because I felt like I let down the guys that I was going with. You know, there were 30 guys who lost their commander, you know, a month into the first tour, and I felt like I needed to do right by them.
You ended up having the charges reduced, though, and there was no problem with you staying on.
That's right. This is the military bureaucracy again at work. I was disciplined under one chain of command, and then when a different one found out, they shredded my paperwork. And so I was given another opportunity, which doesn't necessarily happen. I was, again, fortunate that this other staff organization said, hey, we're going to give you another chance to go back next year.
Was it helpful that these days most service members are able to call home once a week or so?
Helpful? I would rather do that than not do it. And I should say that if we didn't have, this is what's so odd about technology now. Facebook literally didn't exist when I was over there to communicate. So I had a phone call once a week, and I had email that I could check sometimes. But even now, if you're stuck on a mountaintop in Afghanistan, you call home every 3 months. And it's just not everybody has all the connectivity that you do if you're at a main base. But it's good, but you're also helpless. You've been, you wake up in the morning, you go to an IED, you get shot at, you go to a post-blast, you pick up pieces of bodies, you get back to your home base, your wife calls you because you're ahead of time, so it's first thing in the morning, and she wants to talk about how the kids didn't do their homework, and they're crying because they don't want to go to daycare, and, what are you supposed to do about that? You're stuck.
Brian Kastner is my guest. We're talking about his new memoir, The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bronze Star recipient and author Brian Kastner. He's a U.S. Air Force veteran of the Iraq War who currently works as a civilian contractor training explosive ordnance disposal teams for the military. His memoir is called The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Carol who writes, I've heard there have been more deaths from suicide than combat among soldiers and veterans of the Afghan war. Can you comment on why and what you think might be done to help?
Right, that's a really good question. And fortunately, it's getting more attention, so hopefully we'll get a better answer. I'm not the expert on all of the statistics, but my understanding is that the suicide rate among veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan is significantly higher than veterans of other wars, and it's really turning into an epidemic. And I don't want to get the stat wrong to tell you exactly what percentage it is, but it's flabbergasting. I think what it is, just a little bit that I know, is like I mentioned with the traumatic brain injury, that soldiers are surviving blasts that would have killed them in previous wars. The body armor and the armor on the vehicles is such that your body can experience a blast that would have taken off your arm or leg or punctured a lung or something where you would have bled out and died, but instead your body is making it through and your brain is experiencing this. And there's just a brain chemistry issue that that, you know, that where you're affected. So you don't want to, I don't want to flippantly link, you know, there's a lot of suicides in ex-football players and ex-hockey players, and now with veterans. Are those really all the same brain chemistry mechanism of injury? People are doing a lot of research right now to find out.
You describe the old Brian Kastner as having died overseas at some point. It sounds like in some ways by degrees, and you're a new person. What does it take to come to like the new person that you are that has come to replace who you were before?
Yeah, I don't want to get too self-helpy about it, but there was a lot of acceptance that things that I just used to do I don't enjoy doing, and I should figure out what I did like to do. I realized at one point in the middle of kind of the worst of the crazy that I wasn't doing a single thing that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I could barely remember what it was that I enjoyed. And I guess my personality is not completely different. You know, I mean, there are some things the same, but certainly not all of it. And some guys really do have, you know, much more drastic personality changes, I should say. So I do think I enjoy doing things now that I didn't used to before. I'm a whitewater rafting guide. I liked the outdoors before, but I never quite took it to that extent. There's a little bit of adrenaline there, but there's a little bit of, I don't know, figuring out now what I like to do, I guess.
When you think about being a new person, I mean, in some ways, it also opens, if you approach it in the right way, it opens you up to different kinds of experiences. I wonder if that happens sort of after you grieve for what you've lost.
Yeah, it's all kind of mixed together in my head, I guess. And so I like the way you put it. It makes it sound like there's this wonderful opportunity for a fresh start and all of this, like, you know, new things to learn and new, and I wish it felt like that.
Yeah.
But what it really feels like is, you know, your wife married somebody who doesn't act the same way anymore, and she married the other guy, and she wishes you were the other guy lots of times, you know, that she wishes that you made some of the same jokes or at least remembered doing the things together that you used to do. So I don't know if I'm past grieving. You know, I'm grieving for friends that didn't just metaphorically died. I'm grieving for friends that actually died too. So that all gets kind of mixed in there as well. And a lot of writing the book and a lot of the therapy that I went through, I guess, was, like I said before, kind of figuring out which part was due to what.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Chris on the line in Irving. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My question was, even after your guest's sacrifices and his experiences, I was considering enlisting into active duty, and I was wondering if he would still recommend that or if he feels differently about the armed services now.
You know, that's a question that I ask myself, because I personally have no regrets. I'm not sure I would have done exactly everything the same way, but I don't regret anything that I did as far as the choices that I made. But where I think about it is, would I want my sons to enlist? Would I want them to choose the same lifestyle, knowing what happened to me? And I don't have a clear answer to that. I guess I see the tremendous opportunity. I wouldn't trade any of my friends. I wouldn't trade any of my education or experiences, but I don't know if I would wish it on my kids. And there's really no way as well to really mentally prepare somebody else for what they're going to be going into. The military does teach you things you can never learn anywhere else. It does send you to all these different countries and you meet all these great people, but, you know, the transition of coming home and how you deal with it afterwards, I'm not sure somebody could have told me what it was going to be like, and I don't know how to really tell somebody else. I wrote an entire book about it, and I'm not sure I got to the bottom of it.
You have found relief at different points, and it sounds like almost every day in various forms of exercise. You run, you just mentioned the whitewater rafting, you do yoga. We have heard about the sort of biochemical effects that happen from exercise that help with a variety of different mental conditions. But I wonder if for you, you can identify why you feel better when you're running or when you're doing yoga.
At first, it was simply because I was so exhausted that all I could think about is how tired I was, and I didn't have space to think about being crazy. Hmm. And I would just look forward to that run, and I was never a huge runner. This is maybe another good example where I played soccer in high school, and the part I hated about playing soccer was the running. And now I'm in a position where I'm running 15, 18 miles a week is just maintenance. I do that instead of taking a pill. Some people, you know, have to, you know, they've got high blood pressure, and so they take a pill every day, and I have to run every day to kind of keep my chemicals in balance. So at first it was just the exhaustion. And then eventually I've done a lot of reading and research on my own, and you read some of these stories that they're finding links between activities where you have to use both sides of your body, you know, running with your left foot and right arm and going back and forth, or cross-country skiing or swimming, where just the actual motions help reform some of those paths in your brain. So I'm not the neuroscientist. I can't tell you exactly how or why that works, but it's working for me. So I keep doing it, and I just, you know, I do yoga on Mondays, and I run just about every chance I get.
Is it clear to you the ways in which you are different as a father after your war experience?
It's clear to me that I am very protective, but I'd like to think that I'm also more gentle. There's something funny where when you see extreme violence, you don't even want to raise your voice to your children anymore.
Hmm. You write about getting your son geared up to play ice hockey, which I know is a big sport in many parts of the country, in Buffalo certainly. He was 7 years old at this moment that you write about.
Right. And this is one of those insidious ways that the war was just always there, and I would try to forget about it, and I simply couldn't, because we haven't spent a lot of time talking about you know, kind of the how-to of the war, but part of what we do in EOD is you wear the bomb suit, which people may have seen in movies or whatever. And so it takes a lot of time and care. You have to put somebody else in the bomb suit. And just all of those motions of doing that is exactly the same as getting my son, you know, put in his hockey gear, every strap and buckle and putting the helmet on last and every little bit of it. And so there's this stereotype, I think, among people that don't know veterans or are not a veteran, that the things that bother a veteran are, like I mentioned, the fireworks or war movies or violent video games, and they have flashbacks, and there's this parody of it that you see. But for me, the part that was the problem was little things every day that were too much like doing stuff I used to do in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So my son in his hockey gear, the rumble of a diesel engine, you know, all of these little things that you encounter every single day, you know, would take me back there. I couldn't forget if I wanted to.
Have you come to terms, you write that you still cry more easily than you did before the war. Is that something that you just, that's now part of who you are?
It is. It's the way I'm wired now. I cry every day about something, and I'd like to say I don't get embarrassed, and I've kind of come to terms with it, but maybe I'm not fully as settled in as I should be. I've discovered it's really hard to give readings from the book because I get emotional while I read it.
Mm-hmm.
I recorded the audio book. I was lucky enough to do that, and we had to re-record sections of that. It's part of who I am, so I guess I better get used to it. It's part of that not having a filter anymore.
I wonder if there are times when, on the one hand, you write that early on you didn't necessarily share these feelings with people you didn't think would get it. And yet at other times, you know, if you had, God forbid, you know, lost a limb, people would sort of understand if your behavior seemed off to them at a certain point. And people looking at you wouldn't even necessarily know you're a veteran, and yet you might be displaying these emotions in public.
Right. It's extremely awkward. Because how are you supposed to, how are you supposed to get into a conversation about it? Like, hi, yes, you know, I'm crying right now putting my son in his hockey uniform because, you know, are you going to, like, get into it in the locker room?
Yeah.
You're not really, it's just not how polite society works. So it is, and I've had, you know, now that the book's been out about 2 weeks, and, you know, since we're talking about hockey, some of the hockey dads have come up to me because hockey's starting already. This is what hockey is like, you know, in Buffalo is like football in Texas.
Right.
It's all year long. So, you know, they've come up to me and they're like, well, we had no idea. And I don't think they're referencing that specific incident in the locker room. They just mean in general. I'm just a guy who brings his son to hockey every day.
This is in some ways sort of a trite question, but have you thought about the day that your sons ask you to read this book?
Yes, I have. I think about that all the time because I won't let them read it. In fact, there's a stack of them sitting on the desk in my office, and they don't even want to touch it really. And I've told them it's not a kid's book, and I don't know how old they have to be to read it. They're still young.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that they're young enough that they won't have their own memories of me acting in all of these ways. They'll just know me, and then they'll know that I wrote a book, and then when they read it, maybe some of it'll make sense. But I have to admit, I had never expected to be talking to you. I never expected that it would be published or be as big as it is. I wrote this because I had to, and I got it all out. And I thought, I'll just print out one copy and stick it on my bookshelf and save it for my sons later.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they have questions, at least they'll understand why I was the way I was. Then I figured, you know what, I owe it to my family to at least try to get it published. And instead, you know, here I am.
Is the interview process hard?
Only in that I try to do well, and I try not to cry while I'm talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's with me all the time. It's not like I'm reliving something.
Yeah. It's just a lot to, it's a lot to give of yourself day after day after day.
It can be, but it beats having a real job, and it's it's extremely gratifying because you wrote a book that obviously means a lot to a lot of people. It gets a lot of emotional reactions out of people, and what all a writer wants is to be read. So, and if people have a reaction and then want to talk about it, then that's an honor.
Author Brian Kastner is a U.S. Air Force veteran of the Iraq War and Bronze Star recipient. His new memoir is called The Long Walk, a story of war and the life that follows. Brian, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think and download the podcast every single day online at kera.org/think. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for the show, send those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.